This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Three Dark Crowns by Kendara Blake, performed by Amy Landon. Three dark queens are born in a glen. Sweet little triplets will never be friends. Three dark sisters, all fair to be seen, two to devour, and one to be queen. The Queen's 16th Birthday. December 21st, 4 months until Beltane. Greavesdrake Manor. A young queen stands barefoot on a wooden block with her arms outstretched. She has only her scant underclothes and the long black hair that hangs down her back to fend off the drafts. Every ounce of strength in her slight frame is needed to keep her chin high and her shoulders square. Two tall women circle the wooden block. Their fingertips drum against crossed arms, and their footsteps echo across the cold hardwood floor. "She is thin to the ribs," Genevieve says, and smacks them lightly, as if it might scare the bones farther under the skin. "And still so small. Small queens do not inspire much confidence. The others on the council cannot stop whispering about it." She studies the queen with distaste, her eyes dragging across every imperfection, her hollow cheeks, her pallid skin, the scabs from a rubbing of poison oak that still mar her right hand. But no scars. They are always careful about that. "Put your arms down," Genevieve says, and turns on her heel. Queen Catherine glances at Natalia, the taller and elder of the two Aaron sisters, before she does. Natalia nods, and the blood rushes back to Catherine's fingertips. "She will have to wear gloves tonight," Genevieve says. Her tone is unmistakably critical. But it is Natalia who determines the queen's training, and if Natalia wants to rub Catherine's hands with poison oak 1 week before her birthday, then she will. Genevieve lifts a lock of Catherine's hair. Then she pulls it, hard. Catherine blinks. She has been prodded back and forth by Genevieve's hand since she stepped onto the block, jerked so roughly at times that it seems Genevieve wants her to fall, so she can scold her for the bruises. Genevieve pulls her hair again. At least it is not falling out. But how can black hair be so dull? And she is still so, so small. "She is the smallest and the youngest of the triplets," Natalia says, in her deep, calm voice. "Some things, sister, you cannot change." When Natalia steps forward, it is difficult for Catherine to keep her eyes from following her. Natalia Aaron is as close to a mother as she will ever know. It was her silk skirt that Catherine burrowed in at the age of 6, all that long way from the black cottage to her new home at Greavesdrake Manor, sobbing after being parted from her sisters. There was nothing queenly about Catherine that day, but Natalia indulged her. She let Catherine weep and ruin her dress. She stroked her hair. It is Catherine's earliest memory, the one and only time Natalia ever allowed her to act like a child. In the slanting, indirect light of the parlor, Natalia's ice-blonde bun appears almost silver. But she is not old. Natalia will never be old. She has far too much work and far too many responsibilities to allow it. She is the head of the Aaron family of poisoners and the strongest member of the Black Council. She is raising their new queen. Genevieve grasps Catherine's poisoned hand. Her thumb traces the pattern of scabs until she finds a large one and picks it until it bleeds. "Genevieve," Natalia cautions, "that is enough." "Gloves are fine, I suppose," Genevieve says, though she still seems cross. "Gloves over the elbows will give shape to her arms." She releases Katerine's hand and it bounces against her hip. Katerine has been on the block for over an hour, and there is much day still ahead. All the way to nightfall, her party and the Gave Noir, the poisoner's feast. Just thinking of it makes her stomach clench, and she winces slightly. Natalia frowns. "You have been resting?" she asks.
"Yes, Natalia," says Katerine.
"Nothing but water and thinned porridge?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing to eat but that for days, and it may still not be enough. The poison she will have to consume, the sheer amounts of it, may still overcome Natalia's training. Of course it would be nothing at all if Katerine's poisoner gift were strong." Standing on the block, the walls of the darkened parlor feel heavy. They press in, given weight by the sheer number of errands inside. They have come from all across the island for this, the Queen's 16th birthday. Greavesdrake usually feels like a great, silent cavern, empty save for Natalia and the servants, her siblings, Genevieve and Antonin, and Natalia's cousins, Lucien and Allegra, when they are not at their houses in town. Today it is busy and decked with finery. It is packed to purpose with poisons and poisoners. If a house could smile, Greavesdrake would be grinning. "She has to be ready," Genevieve says. "Every corner of the island will hear about what happens tonight." Natalia cocks her head at her sister. The jester manages to convey at once how sympathetic Natalia is to Genevieve's worries and how tired she is of hearing about them. Natalia turns to look out the window, down the hills to the capital city of Indrid Down. The twin black spires of the Volroy, the palace where the queen resides during her reign, and where the Black Council resides permanently, rises above the chimney smoke. "Genevieve, you are too nervous."
"Too nervous?" Genevieve asks. "We are entering the ascension year with a weak queen. If we lose, I will not go back to Prynne."
Her sister's voice is so shrill that Natalia chuckles. "Prynne. It was once the poisoner's city, but now only the weakest reside there. The entire capital of Indrid Down is theirs now. It has been for over 100 years.
"Genevieve, you have never even been to Prynne."
"Do not laugh at me."
"Then do not be funny. I do not know what you are about sometimes."
She looks again out the window, toward the Volroy's black spires. 5 Arryns sit on the Black Council. No less than 5 have sat on it for 3 generations, placed there by the ruling poisoner queen. "I am only telling you what you may have missed, being so often away from council business, coaching and coddling our queen."
"I do not miss anything," says Natalia, and Genevieve lowers her eyes.
"Of course. I am sorry, sister. It is only that the council grows wary, with the temple openly backing the elemental."
"The temple is for festival days and for praying over sick children."
Natalia turns and taps Katerine beneath the chin. "For everything else, the people look to the council." "Why do you not go out to the stables and ride, Genevieve?" she suggests.
"It will settle your nerves. Or return to the Volroy. Some business there is sure to require attention."
Genevieve closes her mouth. For a moment, it seems that she might disobey or reach up toward the block and slap Katerine across the face, just to relieve her tension.
"That is a good idea," Genevieve says. "I will see you tonight then, sister."
After Genevieve has gone, Natalia nods to Katerine.
"You may get down."
The skinny girl's knees shake as she climbs off the block, careful not to stumble.
"Go to your rooms,"
Natalia says, and turns away to study a sheaf of papers on a table. "I will send Giselle with a bowl of porridge, then nothing else besides a few sips of water." Katerine bows her head and drops half a curtsy for Natalia to catch from the corner of her eye. But she lingers.
"Is it,"
Katerine asks,
"is it really as bad as Genevieve says?"
Natalia regards her a moment, as though deciding whether she will bother to answer.
"Genevieve worries," she says finally. "She has been that way since we were children. No, Kat, it is not so bad as all that."
She reaches out to tuck some strands of hair behind the girl's ear. Natalia often does that when she is pleased.
"Poisoner queens have sat the throne since long before I was born. They will sit it long after you and I are both dead."
She rests her hands on Katerine's shoulders. Tall, coldly beautiful Natalia. The words from her mouth leave no room for arguments, no space for doubt. If Katerine were more like her, the Aarons would have nothing to fear. "Tonight is a party," says Natalia, "for you on your birthday. Enjoy it, Queen Katerine, and let me worry about the rest." Seated before her dressing mirror, Queen Katerine studies her reflection as Giselle brushes out her black hair in long, even strokes. Katerine is still in her robe and underclothes and is still cold. Greavesdrake is a drafty place that clings to its shadows. Sometimes it seems that she has spent most of her life in the dark and chilled to the bone. On the right side of her tableau is a glass-sided cage. In it, her coral snake rests, fat with crickets. Katerine has had her since she was a hatchling, and she is the only venomed creature Katerine does not fear. She knows the vibrations of Katerine's voice and the scent of her skin. She has never bitten her, even once. Katerine will wear her to the party tonight, coiled around her wrist like a warm, muscular bracelet. Natalia will wear a black mamba. A small snake bracelet is not as fancy as one draped across one's shoulders, but Katerine prefers her little adornment. She is prettier, red and yellow and black. Toxic colors, they say. The perfect accessory for a poisoner queen. Katerine touches the glass, and the snake lifts her rounded head. Katerine was instructed to never give her a name, told over and over that she was not a pet. But in Katerine's head, she calls the snake sweetheart. "Don't drink too much champagne," Giselle says, as she gathers Katerine's hair into sections. "It is sure to be envenomed or stained with poison juice. I heard talk in the kitchen of pink mistletoe berries."
"I will have to drink some of it," says Katerine. "They are toasting my birthday, after all."
Her birthday and her sister's birthdays. All across the island, the people are celebrating the 16th birthday of the newest generation of triplet queens.
"Wet your lips, then," says Giselle. "Nothing more. It is not only the poison to be mindful of, but the drink itself. You are too slight to handle much without turning sloppy."
Giselle weaves Katerine's hair into braids and twists them high upon the back of her head, wrapping them around and around into a bun. Her touch is gentle. She does not tug. She knows that the years of poisoning have weakened the scalp. Katerine reaches for more makeup, but Giselle clucks her tongue. The queen is already powdered too white. An attempt to hide the bones that jut from her shoulders and to disguise the hollows in her cheeks. She has been poisoned thin. Nights of sweating and vomiting have made her skin fragile and translucent as wet paper. "You are pretty enough already," Giselle says, and smiles into the mirror. "With those big, dark doll's eyes." Giselle is kind, her favorite of the Greavesdrake's maids. But even the maid is more beautiful than the queen in many ways, with full hips and color in her face, blonde hair that shines, even though she has to dye it the ice blonde that Natalia prefers. "Doll's eyes," Katerine repeats. "Perhaps, but they are not lovely. They are big, black orbs in a sickly visage." Looking into the mirror, she imagines her body in pieces, bones, skin, not enough blood. It would not take much to break her down to nothing, to strip away scant muscles and pull the organs out to dry in the sun. She wonders often whether her sisters would break down similarly, if underneath their skin they are all the same. Not one poisoner, one naturalist, and one elemental.
"Genevieve thinks that I will fail," Katerine says. "She says I am too small and weak."
"You are a poisoner queen," says Giselle. "What else matters but that? Besides, you are not so small, not so weak. I have seen both weaker and smaller."
Natalia sweeps into the room in a tight black sheath. They should have heard her coming, heels clicking against the floors and ringing off the high ceilings. They were too distracted. "Is she ready?" Natalia asks, and Katerine stands. Being dressed by the head of the Aaron household is an honor, reserved for festival days and the most important of birthdays. Giselle fetches Katerine's gown. It is black and full-skirted, heavy. There are no sleeves, but black satin gloves to cover the poison oak scabs have already been laid out. Katerine steps into the gown, and Natalia begins to fasten it. Katerine's stomach quivers. Sounds of the party assembling have begun to trickle up the stairs. Natalia and Giselle slide the gloves onto her hands. Giselle opens the snake's cage. Katerine fishes out Sweetheart, and the snake coils obediently around her wrist.
Is it drugged? Natalia asks.
Perhaps it should be. She will be fine, Katerine says, and strokes Sweetheart's scales. She is well-mannered.
As you say.
Natalia turns Katerine to the mirror and places her hands on her shoulders.
Never before have three queens of the same gift ruled in succession. Sylvia, Nicola, and Camille were the last three. All were poisoners raised by Aarons. One more, and perhaps it will become a dynasty. Perhaps only the poisoner queen will be allowed to grow up, and her sisters will be drowned at birth.
There will be nothing too surprising in the Gave Noir, Natalia says. Nothing that you have not seen before. But just the same, do not eat too much. Use your tricks. Do as we practiced.
It would be a good omen, Katerine says softly, if my gift were to come tonight, on my birthday, like Queen Hadley's did.
You have been lingering in the library histories again.
Natalia sprays a bit of jasmine perfume onto Katerine's neck, and then touches the braids piled onto the back of her head. Natalia's ice-blonde hair is fashioned in a similar style, perhaps as a show of solidarity.
Queen Hadley was not a poisoner. She had the war gift. It is different.
Katerine nods as she is turned left and right, less a person than a mannequin, rough clay upon which Natalia can work her poison craft.
You are a little skinny, Natalia says. Camille was never skinny, she was almost plump.
She looked forward to the Gave Noir as a child to a festival feast.
Katerine's ears prick at the mention of Queen Camille.
Despite being raised as Camille's foster sister, Natalia almost never talks about the previous queen, Katerine's mother, though Katerine does not think of her that way.
Temple doctrine decrees that queens have no mother or father. They are daughters of the goddess only.
Besides, Queen Camille departed the island with her king consort as soon as she recovered from giving birth, as all queens do. The goddess sent the new queens, and the old queen's reign was ended.
Still, Katerine enjoys hearing stories about those who came before. The only story about Camille that Natalia tells is the story of how Camille took her crown, how she poisoned her sisters so slyly and quietly that it took them days to die. How when it was over, they looked so peaceful that had it not been for the froth at their lips, you would have thought they had died in their sleep.
Natalia saw those peaceful, poisoned faces for herself. If Katerine is successful, she will see two more.
You are like Camille, though in other ways, Natalia says and sighs. She loved those dusty books in the library too, and she always seemed so young. She was so young. She only ruled for 16 years after she was crowned. The goddess sent her triplets early.
Queen Camille's triplets were sent early because she was weak. That is what the people whisper. Katerine wonders sometimes how long she will have. How many years she will guide her people before the goddess sees fit to replace her. She supposes that the Aarons do not care. The Black Council rules the island in the interim, and as long as she is crowned, they will still control it.
Camille was like a little sister to me, I suppose, Natalia says.
Does that make me your niece?
Natalia grips her chin.
Do not be so sentimental, she says, and lets Katerine go. For seeming so young, Camille killed her sisters with poise. She was always a very good poisoner. Her gift showed early.
Katerine frowns. One of her own triplets had showed an early gift as well. Mirabella, the great elemental.
I will kill my sisters just as easily, Natalia, Katerine says. I promise, though perhaps when I am finished, they will not look like they are sleeping.
The North Ballroom is filled to the brim with poisoners. It seems that anyone with any claim to Aaron blood, and many other poisoners from Prynne besides, has made the journey to Indrid Down. Catherine studies the party from the top of the main stairs. Everything is crystal and silver and gems, right down to glistening towers of purple belladonna berries wrapped in nets of spun sugar. The guests are almost too refined. The women in black pearls and black diamond chokers, the men in their black silk ties. And they have too much flesh on their bones, too much strength in their arms. They will judge her and find her lacking. They will laugh. As she watches, a woman with dark red hair throws her head back. For a moment, her molars, as well as her throat, as if her jaw has come unhinged, are visible. In Catherine's ears, polite chatter turns to wails, and the ballroom is filled with glittering monsters.
"I cannot do this, Giselle," she whispers, and the maid stops straightening the gown's voluminous skirts and grasps her shoulders from behind.
"Yes, you can," she says. "There are more stairs than there were before."
"There are not," Giselle says and laughs.
"Queen Catherine, you will be perfect."
In the ballroom below, the music stops. Natalia has put up her hand.
"You're ready," Giselle says, and checks the fall of the dress one more time.
"Thank you all," Natalia says to her guests in her deep, rolling voice, "for being with us tonight on such an important date. An important date in any year, but this year is more important than most. This year, our Catherine is 16. The guests applaud. "And when the spring comes and it is the time for the Beltane Festival, it will be more than just a festival. It will be the beginning of the Year of Ascension. During Beltane, the island will see the strength of the poisoners during the quickening ceremony. And after Beltane is over, we will have the pleasure of watching our queen deliciously poison her sisters." Natalia gestures toward the stairs. "This year's festival to begin, and next year's festival for the crown." More applause, laughter, and shouts of agreement. They think it will be so easy. 1 year to poison 2 queens. A strong queen could do it in a month, but Catherine is not strong. "For tonight, however," Natalia says, "you simply get to enjoy her company." Natalia turns toward the steep, burgundy-carpeted stairs. A shining black runner has been added for the occasion, or perhaps just to make Catherine slip.
"This dress is heavier than it looked in my closet," Catherine says quietly, and Giselle chuckles.
The moment she steps out from the shadow and onto the stairs, Catherine feels every pair of eyes. Poisoners are naturally severe and exacting. They can cut with a look as easily as with a knife. The people of Fenburn Island grow in strength with the ruling queen. Naturalists become stronger under a naturalist. Elementals stronger under an elemental. After 3 poisoner queens, the poisoners are strong to the last, and the Aarons most of all. Catherine does not know whether she ought to smile. She only knows not to tremble or stumble. She nearly forgets to breathe. She catches sight of Genevieve, standing behind and to the right of Natalia. Genevieve's lilac eyes are like stones. She looks both furious and afraid, as if she is daring Catherine to make a mistake, as if she relishes the prospect of the feel of her hand across Catherine's face. When Catherine's heel lands on the floor of the ballroom, glasses raise and white teeth flash. Catherine's heart eases out of her throat. It will be all right, at least for now. A servant offers a flute of champagne. She takes it and sniffs. The champagne smells a little like oak, and slightly of apples. If it has been tainted, then it was not with pink mistletoe berries, as Giselle suspected. Still, she takes only a sip, barely enough to wet her lips. With her entrance over, the music begins again, and chatter resumes. Poisoners in their best blacks flutter up to her like crows and flutter away just as quickly. There are so many, dropping polite bows and curtsies, dropping so many names, but the only name that matters is Aaron. In minutes, the anxiety begins to squeeze. Her dress suddenly feels tight, and the room suddenly hot. She searches for Natalia, but cannot find her.
"Are you all right, Queen Catherine?"
Catherine blinks at the woman in front of her. She cannot remember what she had been saying.
Yes, she says, of course.
Well, what do you think? Are your sister's celebrations as glorious as this?
Why no, Catherine says. The naturalists will be roasting fish on sticks.
The poisoners laugh.
And Mirabella?
Mirabella is splashing around barefoot in rain puddles.
Catherine turns. A handsome poisoner boy is smiling at her, with Natalia's blue eyes and ice-blonde hair. He holds his hand out.
What else do elementals enjoy doing, after all? He asks. My queen, will you dance?
Catherine lets him lead her to the floor and pull her close. A beautiful blue and green Deathstalker scorpion is pinned to his right lapel. It is still slightly alive. Its legs writhe sluggishly, a grotesquely beautiful ornament. Catherine leans a bit away. Deathstalker venom is excruciating. She has been stung and healed 7 times, but still shows little resistance to its effects.
You saved me, she says. One more moment of fumbling for words and I would have turned to run.
His smile is attentive enough to make her blush. They turn around on the floor and she studies his angular features.
What is your name? She asks.
You must be an Aran. You have their look. And their hair. Unless you have dyed it for the occasion.
He laughs.
What? Like the servants do, you mean? Oh, Aunt Natalia and her appearances.
Aunt Natalia? So you are an Aran?
I am, he says. My name is Peter Reynard. My mother was Paulina Reynard. My father is Natalia's brother, Christoph.
He spins her out.
You dance very well.
His hand slides across her back, and she tenses when he ventures too close to her shoulder, where he might feel the roughness from a past poisoning that toughened her skin.
It is a wonder, she says, given how heavy this gown is. It feels as though the straps are about to draw blood.
Well, you must not allow that. They say the strongest poisoner queens have poison blood. I would hate for any of these vultures to steal you away looking for a taste.
Poison blood. How disappointed they would be, then, if they tasted hers.
Vultures, she says, are not many of the people here your family?
Yes, precisely.
Catherine laughs and stops only when her face drops too near the Deathstalker. Peter is tall, and taller than her by almost a head. She could easily dance, looking the scorpion in the eyes.
You have a very nice laugh, says Peter, but this is so strange. I expected you to be nervous.
I am nervous, she says. The Gave...
Not about the Gave. About this year. The quickening at the Beltane Festival. The start of everything.
The start of everything, she says softly.
Many times Natalia has told her to take things as they come, to keep from becoming overwhelmed. So far it has been easy enough. But then Natalia makes it all sound so simple.
I will face it, as I have to, Catherine says, and Peter chuckles.
So much dread in your voice. I hope you can muster a bit more enthusiasm when you meet your suitors.
It will not matter. Whichever king consort I choose, he will love me when I am queen.
Would you not rather they loved you before then? He asks.
I should think that is what anyone would wish, to be loved for themselves and not their position. She is about to spout the appropriate rhetoric. Being queen is not a position. Not just anyone can be queen. Only her, or one of her sisters, is so linked to the goddess. Only they can receive the next generation of triplets. But she understands what Peter means. It would be sweet to be cared for despite her faults, and to be wanted for her person rather than the power she comes with.
And would you not rather that they all loved you? He says, instead of just one.
Peter Reynard, she says, you must have come from far away if you have not heard the whispers. Everyone on the island knows where the suitor's favors will go. They say my sister Mirabella is beautiful as starlight. No one has ever said anything half so flattering about me.
But perhaps that is all it is, he says, flattery. And they also say that Mirabella is half mad, prone to fits and rages, that she is a fanatic and a slave to the temple, and that she is strong enough to shake down a building.
He eyes the roof over their heads and Catarine smiles. She had not meant Greavesdrake. Nothing in the world is strong enough to tear Greavesdrake from its foundation. Natalia would not allow it.
And what about your sister Arsinoe, the naturalist? Peter asks casually.
They both laugh. No one says anything about Arsinoe.
Peter turns Catarine again around the dance floor. They have been dancing a long time. People have begun to notice. The song ends, their third or perhaps their fourth. Peter stops dancing and kisses the tips of the queen's gloved fingers.
I hope to see you again, Queen Catarine, he says.
Catarine nods. She does not notice how silent the ballroom has become until he is gone, and the chatter returns, bouncing off the south wall of mirrors and echoing until it reaches the carved tiles of the ceiling. Natalia catches Catarine's eye from the center of a cluster of black dresses. She ought to dance with someone else, but the long black-clothed table is already surrounded by servants like so many ants, setting the silver trays for the feast. The Gave Noir. Sometimes it is called the Black Glut. It is a ritual feast of poison, performed by poisoner queens at nearly every high festival. And so, weak gift or not, Catarine must perform it as well. She must hold the poison down past the last bite, until she is shut safely in her rooms. None of the visiting poisoners can be allowed to see what comes after. The sweat, and the seizures, and the blood. When the cellos begin, she almost runs to leave. It seems too soon, that she should have had more time. Every poisoner who matters is in the ballroom tonight. Every Aaron from the Black Council, Lucian and Genevieve, Allegra and Antonin, Natalia. She cannot bear to disappoint Natalia. The guests move toward the set table. The crowd, for once, is a help, pressing close in a wave of black to push her forward. Natalia instructs the servants to reveal the dishes from under their silver covers. Piles of glistening berries, hens stuffed with hemlock dressing, candied scorpions and sweet juice steeped with oleander. A savory stew winks red and black with rosary peas. The sight of it makes Catarine's mouth run dry. Both the snake on her wrist and her bodice seem to squeeze.
Are you hungry, Queen Catarine? Natalia asks.
Catarine slides a finger along Sweetheart's warm scales. She knows what she is supposed to say. It is all scripted, practiced.
I am ravenous.
What would be the death of others will nourish you, Natalia continues. The goddess provides. Are you pleased? Catarine swallows hard. The offering is adequate. Tradition mandates that Natalia bow. When she does, it looks unnatural, as if she is a clay pot cracking. Catarine sets her hands on the table. The rest of the feast is up to her, its progression, its duration and speed. She may sit or stand as she likes. She does not need to eat at all, but the more she eats, the more impressive it is. Natalia advised her to ignore the flatware and use her hands, to let the juices run down her chin. If she were as strong a poisoner as Mirabella is an elemental, she would devour the entire feast. The food smells delicious, but Catarine's stomach can no longer be fooled. It tries to twist itself shut and cramps painfully. The hen, she says. A servant sets it before her. The room is heavy and so full of eyes as it waits. They will shove her face into it if they have to. Catarine rolls her shoulders back. 7 of the 9 council members stand close at the front of the crowd. The 5 who are Aarons, of course, as well as Lucian Marlowe and Paola Vend. The 2 remaining members have been dispatched as a courtesy to her sister's celebrations. There are only 3 priestesses in attendance, but Natalia says that priestesses do not matter. High Priestess Luca has forever been in Mirabella's pocket, abandoning temple neutrality in favor of believing Mirabella to be the fist that will wrest power away from the Black Council.
But the Black Council is what counts on the island now, and priestesses are nothing but relics and nursemaids. Catherine tears white meat from the plumpest part of the breast, the meat that is farthest from the toxic stuffing. She pushes it through her lips and chews. For a moment, she is afraid she will be unable to swallow. But the bite goes down, and the crowd relaxes. She calls for the candied scorpions next. Those are easy. Pretty sparkling sweets in golden sugar coffins. All the venom is in the tail. Catherine eats four sets of pincers and then calls for the venison stew with rosary peas. She should have saved the stew for last. She cannot get around its poison. The rosary peas have seeped into everything, every sliver of meat and drop of gravy. Katerine's heart begins to pound. Somewhere in the ballroom, Genevieve is cursing her for a fool. But there is nothing to be done. She has to take a bite and even lick her fingers. She sips the tainted juice and then cleanses her palate with cold, clear water. Her head begins to ache, and her vision changes as her pupils dilate. She does not have long before she sickens, before she fails. She feels the weight of so many eyes, and the weight of their expectations. They demand that she finish. Their will is so strong that she can nearly hear it. The pie of wild mushrooms is next, and she eats through it quickly. Her pulse is already uneven, but she is unsure whether that is from the poison or just nerves. The speed at which she eats does a good impression of enthusiasm, and the errands clap. They cheer her on. They make her careless, and she swallows more mushrooms than she intends. One of the last chunks tastes like arugula, but that should not be. They are too dangerous. Her stomach seizes. The toxin is fast and violent. The berries. She pops two into her mouth and cheeks them, and then reaches for tainted wine. Most of it she lets leak down her neck and onto the front of her gown, but it does not matter. The Gave Noir is over. She slams both hands down onto the table. The poisoners roar. This is but a taste, Natalia declares. The Gave Noir for the quickening will be something of legend. Natalia, I need to go, she says and grasps Natalia's sleeve. The crowd quiets. Natalia discreetly tugs loose. What? She asks. I need to leave, Catherine shouts. But it is too late. Her stomach lurches. It happens so fast, there is no time even to turn away. She bends at the waist and vomits the contents of the gave down onto the tablecloth. I will be all right, she says, fighting the nausea. I must be ill. Her stomach gurgles again. But even louder are the gasps of disgust, the rustling of gowns as the poisoners back away from the mess. Catherine sees their scowls through eyes that are bloodshot and full of water. Her disgrace is reflected in every expression. Will someone please, Catherine says and gasps at the pain, take me to my rooms. No one comes. Her knees strike hard against the marble floor. It is not an easy sickness. She is wet with sweat. The blood vessels have burst in her cheeks. Natalia, she says, I'm sorry. Natalia says nothing. All Catherine can see are Natalia's clenched fists and the movement of her arms as she silently and furiously directs guests to leave the ballroom. Throughout the space, feet shuffle in a hurry to leave, to get as far from Catherine as they can. She sickens again and pulls on the tablecloth to cover herself. The ballroom darkens. Servants begin to clear the tables as another twisting cramp tears through her small body. Disgraced as she is, not even they will move to help her. Wolf Spring. Camden is stalking a mouse through the snow. A little brown mouse has found itself in the middle of a clearing. And no matter how quickly it skitters across the surface, Camden's large paws cover more ground, even when she's sunk up to her knees. Jules watches the macabre game with amusement. The mouse is terrified, but determined, and Camden looms over it, as excited as if it were a deer or a large chunk of lamb instead of less than a mouthful. Camden is a mountain cat, and at 3 years old has reached her full, massive size. She is a far cry from the milky-eyed cub who followed Jules home from the woods, young enough then to still have her spots, and with more fuzz than fur. Now she is sleek and honey gold, and the only black left is on her points, ears, toes, and the tip of her tail. Snow flies in twin shoots from her paws as she pounces, and the mouse scurries faster for the cover of the bare brush. Despite their familiar bond, Jules does not know whether the mouse will be spared or eaten. Either way, she hopes that it is over soon. The poor mouse still has a long way to run before it reaches cover, and the chase has begun to look like torture. Jules, this isn't working. Queen Arsinoe stands in the center of the clearing, dressed all in black as the queens do, looking like an ink blot in the snow. She has been trying to bloom a rose from a rosebud, but in the palm of her hand, the bud remains green and firmly closed. Pray, Jules says. They have sung this same song 1,000 times over the years, and Jules knows what comes next. Arsinoe holds out her hand. Why don't you help? To Jules, the rosebud looks like energy and possibilities. She can smell every drop of perfume tucked away inside. She knows what shade of red it will be. Such a task should be easy for any naturalist. It should be especially easy for a queen. Arsinoe ought to be able to bloom entire bushes and ripen whole fields, but her gift has not come. Because of that weakness, no one expects Arsinoe to survive the ascension year. But Jules will not give up, not even if it is the queen's 16th birthday and Beltane is in 4 months' time, falling like a shadow. Arsinoe wiggles her fingers and the bud rolls from side to side. Just a little push, she says, to get me started. Jules sighs. She is tempted to say no. She should say no. But the unbloomed bud is like an itch that needs scratching. The poor thing is dead anyway, cut off from its parent plant in the hothouse. She cannot let it wither and wrinkle still green. Focus, she says. Join me. Mm-hmm, Arsinoe nods. It does not take much, hardly a thought, a whisper. The rosebud pops like a bean skin in hot oil, and a fat, fancy-petaled red rose uncurls in Arsinoe's hand. It is bright as blood and smells of summer. Done, Arsinoe declares, and sets the rose on top of the snow. And not bad, either. I think I did most of those petals at the center. Let's do another, says Jules, fairly certain that she did it all. Perhaps they should try something else. She heard starlings while on the path up from the house. They could call them until they filled the bare branches around the clearing. Thousands of them, until not a single starling remained anywhere else in Wolf Spring, and the trees seethed with black, speckled bodies. Arsinoe's snowball hits Camden in the face, but Jules feels it as well. The surprise, and a flicker of irritation as the cat shakes the flakes from her fur. The second ball hits Jules on the shoulder, just high enough for the exploding snow to find its way into the warm neck of her coat. Arsinoe laughs. You are such a child, Jules shouts angrily, and Camden snarls and jumps. Arsinoe barely dodges the attack. She covers her face with her arm and ducks, and the cougar's claws sail over her back. Arsinoe! Camden backs off and slinks away, ashamed. But it is not her fault. She feels what Jules feels. Her actions are Jules' actions. Jules rushes to the queen and inspects her quickly. There is no blood, no claw marks or tears in Arsinoe's coat. I'm sorry. It's all right, Jules. Arsinoe rests a steadying hand on Jules' forearm, but her fingers tremble. It was nothing. How many times did we push each other out of trees as children? This is not the same. Those were games. Jules looks at her cougar regretfully. Cam is not a cub anymore. Her claws and teeth are sharp and fast.
I have to be more careful from now on. I will be. Her eyes widen. Is that blood on your ear? Arsinoe takes off her black cap and pulls back her short, shaggy black hair.
No, see? She didn't come close. I know you would never hurt me, Jules, neither of you.
She holds her hand out, and Cam slides under it. Her big, deep purr is the cougar's apology.
I really didn't mean to, says Jules.
I know. We are all under strain. Don't think on it. Arsinoe slips her black cap back on.
And don't tell Grandma Kate. She has enough to worry about.
Jules nods.
She does not need to tell Grandma Kate to know what she would say, or to imagine the disappointment and worry on her face.
After leaving the clearing, Jules and Arsinoe walk down past the docks, through the square toward the winter market. As they pass the cove, Jules raises her arm to Shad Milner standing in the back of his boat, just returned from a run. He nods hello and shows off a fat brown sole. His familiar, a seagull, flaps its wings with pride, though she doubts that the bird was the one who caught the fish.
I hope I don't get one of those, Arsinoe says, and nods at the gull.
This morning, she called for her familiar, like she has every morning since leaving the black cottage as a child. But nothing has come. They continue through the square, Arsinoe kicking through slush puddles and Camden lollygagging behind, unhappy about leaving the powdery wild for the cold stone town. Winter ugliness holds Wolf Spring in a firm grip. Months of freezing and partial thaws have coated the cobblestones with grit. Fog covers the windows, and the snow is mottled brown after being walked through by so many mud-covered feet. With the clouds hanging heavy overhead, the entirety of the town looks as though it is being viewed through a dirty glass.
Take care, Jules mutters, as they pass Martinson's sister's grocery.
She nods toward empty fruit crates. Three troublesome children are ducked down behind them. One is Polly Nichols, wearing her father's old tweed cap. The two boys she does not know, but she knows what they are up to. They each have a rock in their hands. Camden comes to Jules' side and growls loudly. The children hear. They look at Jules and duck lower. The two boys cower, but Polly Nichols narrows her eyes. She has done one naughty thing for every freckle on her face, and even her mother knows it.
Do not throw that, Polly, Arsinoe orders.
But that seems to make it worse. Polly's little lips draw together so tightly that they disappear. She jumps from behind the crates and throws the rock, hard. Arsinoe blocks it with her palm, but the stone manages to skip off and strike the side of her head.
Ow!
Arsinoe presses her hand to the spot where the stone struck. Jules clenches her fists and sends Camden snarling after the children, determined to plant Polly Nichols onto the cobblestones.
I'm fine. Call her back, Arsinoe says.
She wipes the line of blood away as it runs down to her jaw. Little scamps.
Scamps? They are brats, Jules hisses.
They should be whipped. Let Cam tear up Polly's ridiculous hat at least. But Jules calls Camden, and the cat stops at the street corner and hisses.
Joanne Malone!
Jules and Arsinoe turn. It is Luke, owner and operator of Gillespie's Bookshop, looking smart in a brown jacket, his yellow hair combed back from his handsome face.
Small of stature, but large of lion, he says and laughs. Come inside for tea.
As they enter the shop, Jules stretches up on her toes to quiet the brass bell above the door. She follows Luke and Arsinoe past the tall blue-green bookshelves and up the stairs to the landing, where a table is set with sandwiches and a tray of buttery yellow cake slices.
Sit, Luke says, and goes to the kitchen for a teapot.
How did you know we were coming? Arsinoe asks.
I have a good view of the hill. Mind the feathers, Hank's molting.
Hank is Luke's familiar, a handsome black-and-green rooster. Arsinoe blows a feather off the table and reaches for a plate of small muffins. She picks one up and peers at it.
Are those shiny black bits legs? Jules asks her.
And shells, Arsinoe says. Beetle muffins to help Hank grow new feathers.
Birds, she remarks, and sets the muffin down.
You used to want a crow, like Eva,
Jules reminds her. Eva is Jules's grandma Kate's familiar, a large, beautiful black crow. Jules's mother, Madrigal, has a crow as well. Her name is Aria. She is a more delicately boned bird than Eva, and more ill-tempered, much like Madrigal herself. For a long time, Jules thought she would have a crow too. She used to watch the nests, waiting for a fuzzy black chick to fall into her cupped hands. Secretly, though, she had wished for a dog, like her granddad Ellis's white spaniel, Jake, or her aunt Kara's pretty chocolate hound. Now, of course, she would not trade Camden for anything.
I think I would like a fast jackrabbit, Arsinoe says, or a clever black-masked raccoon to help me steal fried clams from Madge.
You will have something far more grand than a rabbit, or a raccoon, Luke says. You're a queen.
He and Arsinoe glance at Camden, so tall that her head and shoulders are visible over the tabletop. Queens familiar or not, nothing could be more grand than a mountain cat.
Perhaps a wolf, like Queen Bernadine, Luke says.
He pours tea for Jules and adds cream and 4 lumps of sugar. Tea for a child, the way she likes it best, but is not allowed to drink at home.
Another wolf in Wolf Spring, Arsinoe muses around a mouthful of cake. At this rate, I'd be happy to have one of the beetles in Hank's muffins.
Don't be pessimistic. My own father did not get his until he was 20.
Luke, Arsinoe says and laughs. Giftless queens don't live until they're 20.
She reaches across the table for a sandwich. Maybe that is why my familiar hasn't bothered, she says. It knows I will be dead anyway in a year.
Oh!
She has dripped blood onto her plate. Polly's thrown rock left a cut, hidden in her hair. Another drop falls onto Luke's fancy tablecloth. Hank hops up and pecks at it.
I had better go clean this up, Arsinoe says.
I'm sorry, Luke. I'll replace it.
Do not think of it, Luke reassures her as she goes to the bathroom.
He puts his chin in his hands sadly.
She'll be the one crowned at next spring's Beltane, Jules. You just wait and see.
Jules stares into her tea, so full of cream that it is almost white.
We have to get through this spring's Beltane first, she says.
Luke only smiles. He is so sure. But in the last 3 generations, stronger naturalist queens than Arsinoe have still been killed. The Aarons are too powerful. Their poison always gets through. And even if it does not, they have Mirabella to contend with. Every ship that sails to the northeast of the island returns telling tales of the fierce Shannon storms besieging the city of Rolanth, where the elementals make their home.
You only hope, you know, Jules says, like I do, because you don't want Arsinoe to die, because you love her.
Of course I love her, says Luke, but I also believe. I believe that Arsinoe is the chosen queen.
How do you know?
I just know. Why else would the goddess put a naturalist as strong as you here to protect her?
Arsinoe's birthday celebration is held in the town square, beneath great black-and-white tents. Every year the tents heat up with food and too many bodies until the flaps have to be opened to allow the winter air in. Every year, most of the attendees are drunk before sundown. As Arsinoe makes her way through, Jules and Camden follow closely. The mood is jovial, but it takes only a second for the whiskey to turn.
It's been a long winter, Jules hears someone say, but the madness has been mild. It's a wonder more fishers haven't been lost on their boats, taking a gaff to the side of the head.
Jules presses Arsinoe past the conversation. There are many people to see before they can sit down to their own food.
These are very well done, Arsinoe says, and leans down to sniff a vase holding a tall spray of wildflowers.
The arrangement is layered with the pinks and purples of hedge nettles and showy orchis. It is as pretty as a wedding cake, early bloomed by the naturalist gift. Each family has brought their own, and most brought extra to decorate the tables of the giftless.
Our Betty did them this year, says the man nearest Arsinoe.
He winks across the table and beams at a blushing girl of around 8, wearing a newly knit black sweater and a braided leather necklace.
Did you, Betty? Well, they are the finest ones here this year. Arsinoe smiles, and Betty thanks her. And if anyone notes that a little girl can do such elegant blooms when the queen cannot open one rose, they do not let it show. Betty's eyes brighten at the sight of Camden, and the big cat walks close to let her pet and stroke her back. The girl's father watches. He nods respectfully at Jules as they go by. The Malones are the most prosperous naturalists in Wolf Spring. Their fields are rich and orchards bountiful. Their woods are full of game. And now they have Jules, the strongest naturalist in some 60 years, it is said. For these reasons and more, they were chosen to foster the naturalist queen and must take on all the responsibilities that go with it, including playing host to visiting members of the council, something that does not come naturally. Inside the main tent, Jules's grandmother and grandfather sit on either side of the honored guest, Renata Hargrove, a member of the Black Council sent all the way from the capital city of Indrid Down. Madrigal ought to be there too, but her seat is empty. She has disappeared, as usual. Poor Kate and Ellis, trapped in their chairs. Grandad Ellis's cheeks will be sore later from holding such a fake smile. On his lap, his little spaniel, Jake, grins a grin that looks less like friendliness and more like bared teeth. They only sent one representative this year, Arsinoe says under her breath. One out of nine, and the giftless one at that. What do you think the council is trying to say? She chuckles and then pops an herb-roasted buttered crab claw into her mouth. Arsinoe hides everything behind the same easygoing smirk. She makes eye contact with Renata, and Renata inclines her head. It is not much of an acknowledgement, barely enough, and Jules's hackles rise. Everyone knows her seat on the council was bought and paid for by her giftless family, she growls. She'd lick the poison off Natalia Aaron's shoes if she asked. Jules glances at the few priestesses from Wolf Spring Temple who have decided to attend. Sending one council member is an insult, but it is still better treatment than Arsinoe has received from the temple. High Priestess Luca has not come to her birthday even once. She went to Katarine's occasionally in the early years. Now it is only Mirabella, Mirabella, Mirabella. Those priestesses should not show their faces, Jules grumbles. The temple should not choose sides. Take it easy, Jules, Arsinoe says. She pats Jules's arm and changes the subject. The sea catch is impressive. Jules turns to the head table, thoroughly stocked with fish and crabs. Her catch forms the centerpiece, an enormous black cod, accompanied by two equally huge silver stripers. She called them from the depths early that morning, before Arsinoe had even gotten out of bed. Now they lie on piles of potatoes, onions, and pale winter cabbage. Most of their juicy fillets have already been picked clean. You shouldn't brush it aside. Jules warns, it matters. The disrespect? Arsinoe asks and snorts. No, it doesn't. She eats another crab claw. You know, if I make it through this ascension year, I would like a shark as my centerpiece. A shark? A great white. Don't be cheap when it comes to my crowning, Jules. Jules laughs. When you make it through the ascension, you can charm your own great white, she says. They grin. Except for her severe coloring, Arsinoe does not look much like a queen. Her hair is rough, and they cannot keep her from cutting it. Her black trousers are the same ones she wears every day, and so is her light black jacket. The only piece of finery they could get her into for the occasion was a new scarf that Madrigal found at Pearson's, made from the wool of their fancy, flop-eared rabbits. But that is probably for the best. Wolf Spring is not a city of finery. It is of fishers and farmers and folk on the docks, and no one wears their fine blacks except on Beltane. Arsinoe studies the tapestry hung behind the head table and frowns. Normally it hangs in the town hall, but it is always dragged out for Arsinoe's birthday. It depicts the crowning of the island's last great naturalist queen, Bernadine, who weighed orchards heavy with fruit when she passed and had an enormous gray wolf for a familiar. In the weaving, Bernadine stands below a tree sagging with apples, with the wolf beside her. In the wolf's jaws is the torn-out throat of one of her sisters,
whose body lies at Bernadine's feet.
I hate that thing, Arsinoe says.
Why?
Because it reminds me of what I'm not.
Jules bumps the queen with her shoulder.
There is seed cake in the dessert tent, she